speaker for the evening, Karen from Lakewood.
I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Larry and Damien for asking me to come and share. I talked to Damien this morning, and it was a warm 26 degrees in New York, where he's on vacation. And, gosh, I'm from Michigan, so I know what that's like. And I went back there a couple years ago. My stepdad had passed away, and you know how people like to get the last word in? I swear he died in January just to get back at me. And it was like 15 below, and you know, cars were stalling, the batteries were freezing up and everything, and then when it got to be like 17, it felt like it was warm and we should be wearing shorts. Hi, how are you? Nice to see you. And he was saying that it's cold. That's very cold. I want to thank you, our 10-minute speaker, and I'm sorry, I can't remember your name, I'm sorry. Joe, thank you. And all the new people that came, and the person who got his 90-day chip, and happy birthday to Kip, and, you know, I have to say that Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. I know that without Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not be standing here for today. And I know, without a shadow of a doubt, that in and of myself, I drink. That's what I do. That's what I've always done. That's my comfort zone. That's where I find my answers. That's where I find my serenity. That's where it doesn't matter how much it kicks my butt. That is where I go when I have problems. And for me to be standing here today not drinking, it has to be a God of my understanding, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the 12 steps and traditions. And without a shadow of a doubt. So everything that I am, anything that I ever will be, is due to Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in it. And as we go through sobriety, I got sober June 9th of 1989. And so I told Kimmy, so I can officially say it's not January yet. I was almost to the point where I could say I'm 24 and a half. But I can't do that till January, so I'm just 24. And I hope everyone had a nice holiday, and you know, it's such a busy time of year. And my first party started the first Saturday in December, and every weekend was booked. And weekends, everything. And I can say that with gratitude today. And I remember one time, it was at a women's meeting. Oh, Tanya, thank you so much for driving with me. There was no traffic. It must have been the holiday. It was great. We just drove 65 speed limit the whole way. And maybe 70, 75. But so no traffic. It was great. But I remember one Christmas, I was 18. And I had just moved out to the San Fernando Valley from this little farm town in Michigan. And it was Christmas Eve, and I was by myself, and I was drunk. And I was alone, and I was scared. And I had told God, never mind, you know, you're God, I'm me, we're two separate issues. You know, I appreciate your gorgeous sunsets once in a while when I'm drunk at the beach. But other than that, you know, we really are two separate things. And but that night, and I was like a long time into my sobriety before I remembered this, I went up to a church. And what I was thinking was, and it was a big church, it was an old church, and I'm thinking I'm going to walk inside and the candles are going to be lit, the priest is going to be there, he's going to hold me in his arms, and he's going to escort me into the front, and I'm going to find God, you know? And he's going to tell me everything's okay. And I get there, and it was locked. And and it was Christmas Eve, and it was locked. And it was like one more time, you know, that door shut. One more time the walls went up. One more time is, you know what, the only person I can depend on is me. You know, one more time. One more time. Never looking at, you know, why maybe it was locked. I don't know, maybe I went to the back door, you know. I mean, maybe it wasn't even a church that I went to. I thought it was a church, you know. I mean, maybe it looked like a church because I was pretty drunk. But the point is that just one more time, the only person I can depend upon is me. And here I am. I'm with so many people over the holidays, and I'm not alone. And at the last minute, it was the day after Christmas, there's a girlfriend. Four of us got sober, one in March, one in May, I'm in June, and Kim's in July of 1989, and we're all still very, very close friends. And, I mean, and that's a gift. I mean, to have friends for that amount of time, to have a history with someone, to have a history, and to have people know absolutely every single thing about me. You know, all the good stuff, all the bad stuff, all the piddly little stuff, you know, all the chicken shit stuff, all of that. And I'm still friends with them, and I can still look them in the eye, and I still know they love me. And so she ended up, Tama had moved up to Northern California, and they ended up coming down, and it worked all out. We all got together. We had like this Christmas, after Christmas dinner. And it was just weird. It just all just unfolded beautifully. And one more time, you know what? I don't have to plan everything. I don't have to control everything. I don't have to be there in there doing stuff, even though I like to. And I'm a controller, you know, there's no doubt. But if I allow my life just to unfold, and if I allow myself to just do what I'm supposed to be doing, it really, really is a beautiful, beautiful thing. I'm a gallon-a-day vodka drinker. I drink a lot. When I drink that much, I don't do much, you know. I puke. And I hope to hell I don't run out before the liquor store opens. Because if I run out before the liquor store opens, I'm in big trouble. And I can't tell you how many times I would go to the liquor store. And I would drive there. And I don't even know how I would get there. And I would just be standing there. And I would just have to, whoever was behind the counter, I would just have to hand him my purse, hand him my wallet, hand him my jack, wherever the money was, because I would just be shaking so bad I couldn't get the money out and I didn't want them to see me. And one more time, I'm still doing the story, you know, the story. Like, we're having a party tonight. Yeah, okay, it's 6 a.m. You know, I like to prepare. And you know, I mean, and this is a liquor store where the guy already puts the bottle on the counter when he sees me pull up, you know. And I'm still got to tell the story. And I had so many liquor stores that I would bounce around to so I wouldn't know. Because for a long, long time, I wouldn't just buy a gallon of vodka because an alcoholic drinks a gallon of vodka. And an alcoholic doesn't drink a pint, you know? And so I would get a pint here and a pint there, pint here, pint there, fifth there, quart there. Always, always fooling myself because I always have that alcoholic delusion that somehow, someday I can enjoy and control my drinking. Somehow, someday I'm going to be able to beat this thing. Somehow, someday I'm going to be able to have a glass of wine like a lady at a fine restaurant. And it's going to be great. Maybe a little liqueur afterwards, and I won't even finish it. You know, I'll just leave it there and walk away, and everybody will see, you know, and they're all paying attention. And I never, ever drank like that, ever. I mean, what an illusion. What an absolute illusion that I had. And never drank like that, but that's how I'm going to do it. And every single time, it always ended up the same. Every single time. When we talk about that story of the in the big book about the jaywalker, I mean, that's me. It was the first thing I ever related to in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was the jaywalker. I go across the street, and I get hit. And I think, you know what, tomorrow I'm going to cross that street, and I'm not going to get hit. And I get hit again and again and again. And it was just like... the lights went on, and it was like, oh, my God, to live in such an enclosed world of only me and to be able to make just a threat of identification is amazing. And I hope I never, ever forget that because it was like you might as well have just, you know, it was like I just won the Mega Lotto, you know, and because for once something inside of me said there might just be a ray of hope for me. Just maybe something different will happen. I don't know what it is. I don't even know, but maybe just something different can happen. And I'm going to try to just stay a little bit in my drinking. I don't know why I get into my drinking stories, and I guess I like hearing them because I can get stuck on them for a while. So, Kimmy, tell me, all right? Just say, quit with the drinking stuff. And, love the war stories, huh? But I'm sober longer than I drink. And I mean, so therefore, that's, I have a lot of stuff that happened in sobriety. And it's an amazing, amazing thing. I started drinking, like I said, well, I grew up in this little farm town in Michigan. My dad was a terrible, terrible, mean alcoholic. I was afraid all the time. I don't remember my childhood very much. I think I really don't remember until like maybe second grade, kind of. But what I do remember is always being afraid. And my dad used to beat us so bad that we couldn't go to school. And sometimes we wouldn't know why. He could just come home from in a drunken rage and just beat us. And so you never knew when, and you never knew how or why. It didn't matter if you were a good girl, it didn't matter if you were a bad girl. It just didn't matter, but something was going to happen. And so I lived with that fear. And I mean, I carried that fear throughout me my whole entire life, that self-centered fear. And you know, I mean, today in sobriety, I mean, 24 years, that doesn't mean I'm still who I am, you know? I mean, I can clean up and I can clean house and I can do all of those things, but there's still those things inside of me that are always going to be there. It's just, you know, how well I deal with them. You know, so I can still get afraid. I can still get scared. Just all the same thing that can bring me back to when I was that little tiny girl, you know. But I will say that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has truly, truly moved me so forward in that department. And along with the traditions, I mean, they're just as important. As I've always said, the steps help me live with me, and the traditions help me live with you. And we lived in this little town, and so my dad was always beating everybody up. And my mom divorced him, I think, when I was in third grade. And we moved into this old farmhouse, and we didn't have any money. And I just remember being ashamed. And I didn't ever think, God, you know, Mom, you're doing such a great job or any of that stuff. I was just ashamed. Like, we had this car, and it didn't have a floorboard. You know, it was had, like, cardboard, you know. And in Michigan, slushy, rainy weather, not such a great deal, right? So we'd hit a puddle. My mom would say lift, and we'd all lift our legs, our feet up, and that thing would all splash up, and then it'd go back down. And I would always want her to drop me off a couple blocks from school because I never wanted anybody to see what I was doing. And she made all of our clothes, and I was always ashamed of that. And, I mean, can you imagine, I mean, having – I had my own seamstress, and I didn't even appreciate it. Can you imagine having that now? Oh, my God, you know. And she tried to teach me how to sew, and I'm just like, I wasn't having any part of that. And again, I wish I would have, because I can sew a button on, and that's about it. I mean, just all of these things, it just collectively made who I was. And it was, what I was is I was a person that despised myself. I never believed I was worthy of anything. I never believed I was worthy to breathe the air in and out. I always believed that if you looked at me, if you looked inside me, you would see that I am absolutely nothing. And this is before I drank. And I mean, and obviously we don't have those words at the time. I mean, it's all in retrospect. It's all, you know, doing a lot of work in Alcoholics Anonymous, do a lot of soul searching and just, or, you know, just the fact of the fog lifting, you know. And so I just never, ever felt good enough for anything. And when I remember writing notes to my dad saying, gosh, if you stop drinking, I'll do this. And I mean, all of this stuff. And I just hated who he was and what he represented. And I became just like him, just exactly like him. And I mean, thank God I never had any children, because who knows? I probably would have done a worse job than my dad. My dad at least held on a job. And at the end, I couldn't keep a job. And he at least could do that. So, I mean, I thank God that I never had any children, because I can't imagine what kind of a mother I would have been. I just can't imagine. And the women and the men who grow up and they have these kids, I mean, God bless you. It's a lot, you know. And when I got sober, I just had to worry about me. I didn't have to worry, you know, about this. You know, it was just me. Everybody completely abandoned me because I was so horrible. And I can't imagine trying to keep a family together. As we say, there's always, my challenges are one thing, but there's somebody that always has a greater one, and that is so true, so true. So fast forward, they got divorced, then my mom remarried, my stepdad and I didn't get along, and then I started getting drunk. And I mean, I was all by myself. When I got drunk, there was no peer pressure, there was no, let's go do, I mean, there was nothing. I just got a bottle and drank. and it just seemed like the right thing to do. It was comfortable, and I liked it because what it did, it made me breathe. I felt like I could breathe. It was like for the first time in my life, I could just take a deep breath, you know, just like I'm waiting to do here in about 5 more minutes. I'll be able to breathe again. And and it made everything fit. Everything was okay. I became a daily drinker by the time I was 15. I always had a pint of vodka in my purse. I never went anywhere without it. Always had it. You know, I'm a dinosaur. Didn't do a lot of drugs. I just drank alcohol. Alcohol made me who it made me. It finished me. When I was drinking, I felt in control. When I wasn't drinking, I felt out of control. And it was the total opposite. My perception of life was completely backwards. Completely backwards. And at least today, when I have my backwards perception, I'm at least able to say, Karen, you're backwards today. You know, don't act on any of this stuff. You know, give it 24 hours, and you might be okay, you know. And one of my very first sponsors, the 24-hour rule. Man, that has saved my life. I can't tell you how many times. 24-hour rule, do not do anything or act on anything. Open your mouth for 24 hours. And it's very, very good when you can do it. You know, not always have I been able to do it. But when I have, it has served me well. And so I started drinking, and immediately, because it made me who I was, I remember, God, I used to be able to drink 2 or 3 beers, and I'd get sick, and I'd want to throw up, and then, you know, at the end, I'm drinking a gallon of vodka a day. What a difference. What a difference. And I got sober when I was 27, right before my 27th birthday. And so as I'm drinking, and we're out in this farm town, you know, we always had keg parties, always had card parties in the winter, always had this, always had that. And, you know, all of a sudden, as I'm going out, and I never did anything intentionally. Like, I never meant to sleep with my girlfriend's boyfriends. It just worked out that way. You know, it was never a thought. And so as I'm thinking, it shouldn't count. You know, I'm thinking, okay, if I didn't mean it, I didn't plan it, I really didn't like him that much, but he had a bottle, so what's going to happen? You know what's going to happen, you know? And I did that throughout my entire drinking career. You know, I can't tell you how many times I would wake up and I wouldn't know where I was, who I was with. And there's nothing like that long walk to the car, you know, especially if you're in a residential neighborhood, right? Oh, my God. You know, they're going to church and you're like out in your my aardvark recycled Madame Wong punk rock clothes and drunk. And hungover, maybe puking on their lawn, and trying to find my car, you know? And I'm sure from the outside, it looked like I was saying, I don't care. You know what? Screw you. Doesn't matter. Quit, you know, and everything. But on the inside, I was dying. On the inside, I'm saying, oh, my God. God, if I could just get up in the morning and go pick up the paper with a cup of coffee in my hand, wave at my neighbors, you know, and just be normal. Just have this something of normality. You know, and then there's nothing worse than when you realize, oh, my God, he drove. And so you got to go back to the house and say, excuse me, but I need you to drive me to my car, you know, and then you get the long drive in the car and you're just like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And it would happen over and over and over and over again. And every single time that would happen, a little piece of me went out. Little piece here, little piece there. First time I think when I was 21 is when I turned 21, I think I stopped drinking in the bars. But up until then, because it was like 18 was the drinking age back then, and so I was drinking in bars by the time, you know, God, since I was like 14. And I look at 14-year-olds now, and I think, whoa, you know, God, how did I do that? Just how did I do that? I was so old. I was so old when I was young. And so we're going to the bars, and I'd always lose my fake IDs, and I'd never put my fake ID with my name on it. Why, I don't know, because you're always drunk before you go to the bar, and they take your card, they ask you your name, and I tell them my name, and it's not the name on the fake ID, and they take it, and I'd be like, oh, my God, Karen. And we just go through this, and this one guy, who I didn't have a fake ID at the time, and I was drinking in this one bar, and one night he asked me to stay and close up the bartender there. You know, and he raped me, and he rolled me, and he threw me in the bushes. He threw me out the back door like a piece of trash. And you know what? I felt I deserved it. There wasn't one part of me that thought, oh, my God, that wasn't right. You know, this is wrong. Instead, you know, I had to wait like about a week before I could go back there. And, of course, I went back there because I don't have a fake ID and I know the guy's going to serve me. You know, and, of course, he doesn't, add insult to injury. And but this is, it was just the way I felt. I just felt like I was worth nothing. And somehow when I drank alcohol, it made me at least be able to put on the facade that I was something. At least be able to just put on the bulletproof vest. You know, be able to look at you guys in the eye, to somehow seem like I'm a part of life. And I was about 10, 12, about 14 years sober. And a man, just like my father, passed away suddenly. And I was between 14 and 16 in my sobriety. I was like this hell on wheels. I was ungrateful, hated everybody, hated Alcoholics Anonymous. Always knew I was. I mean, I never once told myself that I wasn't an alcoholic, which I'm sure absolutely saved my life. Plus, I had been extremely, extremely active up until that point, and I was just kind of in this just rebellion. And I was supposed to go have lunch with this man and Carol, who's like my second mom. And I was supposed to go have lunch with them. And I canceled because I had something more better to do. And he died that night. And one more time, Karen puts the blocks up. Karen puts the walls up. And I'm thinking, this woman has known me my whole life. I mean, she went through the worst of my drinking more than my mom did because Carol's out here in California. And I remember, and we had this rift. I did everything that I was supposed to do, you know, with the funeral. I did everything I was supposed to do, but I couldn't talk to her anymore. I couldn't. It was like, and I'm thinking that she's mad at me. She's mad at me because I didn't go to lunch with them. And it wasn't until, and this went on for probably like a year and a half, and it wasn't until I went up to her and I said, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I didn't go to lunch. I'm sorry I did that. I am so sorry I've been acting the way I was acting. And it wasn't until I owned it did I realize one more time it was me that put the wall in between you. You know, and I always, always thought it was you guys. I always thought I couldn't feel because of you. I always thought something wasn't right because of you. And I mean, again, it's not like I ever had a conscious thought. It wasn't, I mean, for me at the time, it was just, I mean, it was survival mode. I believe if I wasn't drinking sometimes, I probably would have killed myself. There was no way I could have survived some of the stuff that went on in my life. And, you know, but after a while, it started doing to me instead of for me. And so it was like one more time this revelation of, you know what, it's me. It always comes down to me, damn it. Always. And and so then, I mean, ever since then we've had this fabulous relationship. And it just reminds me that that no matter when something is going wrong in a relationship, it's me. And so when I unable to feel with people are coming in and out of my life, I'm doing all this crazy stuff, and then finally I end up moving out of the San Fernando Valley because I was hanging out a lot in Hollywood, and at the time they still had Gazzari's down there, and the Whiskey to Go-Go, and there was Madame Wong's down in Chinatown, and just some just crazy, crazy times. And you know, every once in a while I'd head out to there was a cowboy bar out in North Hollywood. What was the name of that place? Yes. Every once in a while, I'd get my cowboy hat on, you know, and we'd put the Madame Wong clothes away, and I'd be a cowgirl for a while. And because I always had to fit the part, you know, whoever I am, whoever I'm with is who I am. And is that place there anymore? Yeah. Huh, I don't know. I don't want to visit it or anything, but just curious. And and I'm doing all this stuff, and then I realized, you know what, I've just got to get out of this town. You know, this place is, I used to, one of the people that we went drinking with in the Palomino bar, we were in their garage drinking, and his esophagus burst from drinking, and he bled to death. And I kept thinking, that's me. That's going to be me. That's going to be me. I mean, I drank just as much as Greg. And, you know, and at the time, there was a lot of angel dust and PCP going on during that time, kind of like the way crack is now. And, you know, it was like, whoo-hoo, no, thank you. You know, I was always so afraid of drugs, so afraid of drugs, which probably saved my life, because if I would have been a pig with alcohol with drugs, we might have had another problem going on there. And I mean, you know, I did Quaaludes, coke, and, you know, I dabbled in some stuff, but nothing really serious. And just your casual stuff. You know, if I wasn't shooting heroin, I'm not a drug. I didn't use drugs. But so I moved down to Lakewood with this lady like that now is like my mom, and I go back and I start going to school, and, you know, I always have the two lives going on. I always am a good student. I have a job. We have this. We have that. You know, and here I am, this, this, and that, but I've always got my pop-off bottle of vodka. And at the time, they were so glass, unlike the very convenient plastic that you drinkers have now. And because what had happened is I got – when I went into this recovery home at mom – at the end of my drinking, and I'm packing up my meter belongings, and I don't have any matching socks. And I'm like, wow, do I even want to know what that's about? Maybe not. And then I remembered I was working down at this clothing place down in L.A., and which is where I did a lot of cocaine, and casually. And so I would, I was drinking a lot. I really was starting to drink a lot. And, you know, and I, it was off of the 710 and Bandini off of Alameda, which there's a lot of train tracks going down that way into Vernon. And I remember just waiting for a train because I would want to be sick, you know, because I would drink maybe a pint. Now I'm like 20, 22 maybe. And who'd have to take, you know, I'd have to drink about a pint in the morning to get going, try to put the makeup on, puke a couple times. I'm sweating like a pig. You know, then you got to redo the makeup because you're puking and you got the nose snot. And so then I drink some more on the way to work. And then, you know, I mean, sometimes you just get a bad swig, you know, and you got to throw up. So I just used to throw. If I wasn't on a train track so I could open the door and puke, I would have to puke in the passenger seat. And so then I would get to work, and then I just remember working, and it would be like my, you know, because again, kind of like on the outside, I still somewhat look normal. I mean, occasionally people look at me like, there's something about her, but I can't put my finger on it. And they would say, you know, Karen, it's your turn to drive to lunch. Okay, I've got baked puke in my front seat. let me see. Can't do it. So you just got to make up all these stories as to why you can't drive, why you can't go with them. You can't go with them because you're sick. You got to get a bottle. You got dried up puke all over your car. And so you make up this stuff, and they just start looking at me weirdly. And I'm passing out at my desk. And so what I started doing was I would pass out, and I would forget to put my bottle in my purse and zip it up. And so they would be like, Karen, you're drunk. You know, I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm like, is that your vodka bottle in your purse? No. Is that your purse? Is that your desk? Is that your drawer? Yeah, but no, it's not mine. And so I started putting a sock. And then when you have the knee sock in the with the bottle, and I forget to zip up my purse, you can't see it. It's ingenious. And then what I did is then riding home, rather than having 50 bottles of vodka bottles clanking around in my car, you throw it out the window, it's in the sock, it makes a minimum amount of noise, and it's perfect, you know? And that was why I didn't have any matching socks when I got sober. And I had this, and I remember when I figured out, I started bringing a bucket to work with me, which again, another one of those wonderful thoughts. Then I started puking in the bucket instead of in my car. Perfect. Problem solved. Everything's good. Right? You know? And to me, None of this is strange. None of it. It is just solving a problem. It's just trying to make it work. It's just, see, 10 minutes, you didn't tell me, here I am drinking. And so on and on and on and on. Drank. You know, and I can't tell you, I remember one time a cop pulled me over, and I had this little bottle of apple juice and with vodka in it, and it had that layer of mold on top, and I needed a drink, and I smelled it, and it had vodka in it. So we're like, okay, you know, we got to do this. And so I took a drink of that, and then I had eaten spaghetti, and so completely undigested spaghetti all over my windshield, all over the steering wheel, as the cops saw me spew my spaghetti. And so then I pull over. Somehow I get out of it. I say I have the flu or whatever, and I'm just, like, cleaning it up a little bit. And I just go driving onto the grocery store, and everything is normal. My whole life appears to be normal when it is so not normal. It is so not normal. And what ended up happening was at the very end of my drinking, for the last couple of years I was in and out of hospitals. I had pancreatitis 8 times. I would go into a hospital for 1 month at a time, 2 months at a time, 3 months at a time, 4 months at a time. The last time I was in a county hospital, I had gotten married, divorced, didn't have any money, didn't have any place to live. They had shipped me out to Lancaster one more time, and I was there from January until the end of May. I was down to 65 pounds. My hair was basically all falling out. My teeth were loose, and I was dying of malnutrition because I couldn't eat. And they would try to do surgery on me, and my insides were like jello. So finally, the last time they did surgery, they rerouted a bunch of stuff. And then they 7 or 8 days later, they sent me home. And I'm thinking, you know what? I got this now. I got it now. Never mind all the times I would be in that hospital room and I would steal money from the person next to me so that I could go get a cab and go get a bottle and then come back to the hospital. And then, you know, plug my IV back in. I got it down, you know. It's a county hospital. They don't miss me. And over and over again, because I believe I cannot live without drinking. I cannot do it. And so I get home and I'm thinking, you know, I got it made. Now I know. I really know now I can't drink. Self-knowledge avails me nothing, because sooner or later I got to drink because I've got so much poison inside of me. I can't live with the things that I've done. I can't deal with any of the things that I've had to deal with. And so I drink again. The lady who's been taking care of my dog all this time, who I found under that building in L.A., she was like my little child. And I came home like 24 hours later. And I was drunk, and they had told me, you know, you drink one more drop of alcohol and you're dead. You know, that doesn't even occur to me, because the only thing I think about, I do not think about yesterday. I think about now, because now is going to be different. Yesterday was yesterday. Now is going to, I'm going to be able, when I take that first drink, I have the absolute positively think it is going to be different. So I don't have to worry about it, because it's going to be different. It's going to be a glass of wine. You know, and of course it is, and we go on and on. And so she tells me that she's going to kill my dog right in front of me, and I'm going to know what it's like to watch something I love die, because that's what I'm doing to her and every person around me. And I heard that. I heard it. And there were so many things that I should have heard so many other times. And so I just downed all the Percocet that I had, because I still had over 100 stitches in my stomach or staples. And I tried committing suicide with a disposable Bic razor. And I just kept cutting and cutting. Nothing happened. Plus, I was cutting the wrong way. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned how to commit suicide. But and I just finally remember saying, God, please help me. God, please help me. And again, God and I are two separate things. I never, ever, ever asked for his help. And I said, if I can do, as Joe said, if whatever I need to do, I will do. If I need to stand in my head in a corner for the rest of my life, let me do it. I cannot live this way one more day. And I ended up passing out, and I slept that night. And I slept maybe an hour or two at a time, and I would wake up with the nightmares and everything. Because when you're drinking that much, you constantly got to be putting something in you to keep the nightmares away. And I woke up and I went into a recovery house in Bellflower, a little house recovery home. And I mean, I didn't go hat skipping and jumping, yay, here's my life. And I went there and I was absolutely, totally 100% surrendered. And for me, the obsession to drink was lifted. it happens differently for everybody. Everybody has a path that they want. They, you know, and I really believe that God knows exactly, he knows how we're supposed to get here. And for me, it was that. Now, mind you, I tried about four months sober, and I was in a little bit of a jackpot, and I tried, okay, God, please help me. God, please help me. Did it work? You know, and it didn't, you know. God said, I gave you this one time. Now you got to work for it. And so I've had to work for my sobriety ever since. Absolutely. Sometimes it's work. Sometimes it's fun. Sometimes it's, you know, it is what it is. It's life. It's life on life's term. And so going to this little recovery home, we started walking over to the Monday night meeting of the Bellflower Big Book group, which I still, that's my home group today. I've been going there since before my 30 days. And when I got out of that place, a bunch of girls picked me up that night. From where I was living, they picked me up and they took me to a meeting. And I remember Joni, oh my God, the way she would drive is she got scared. She closed her eyes. And I'm like, oh great. Yeah, sobriety. Whew, yeah. And a lot of the girls were a lot younger than me. They had matchy-matchy outfits, big bows. It was like, you know, Madonna, 80s, all this stuff. And, you know, I was more of a sweats and flannel type of girl. And so they taught me how to dress. They taught me how to be. They taught me how to get a job. They taught me how to be a lady. They taught me how to be a daughter, a mother. I mean, those girls taught me everything. And, I mean, there is, I would say 95% of those women are still in my lives today. We go to the Palm Springs once a year. We have an annual Christmas party that we all get together. And, you know, all of us have kids. We've been divorced. Some have grandkids. I mean, you know, I have this huge history. I have a huge history with so many people in my home group. I mean, it's amazing because I don't always like them, you know, but I know that I stay. I stay and it'll pass because nothing lasts forever. Nothing lasts forever but change, as they say. And, I mean, through things, one of my best friends ended up, she had hepatitis and she had to get a liver transplant. And, I mean, she was dead. She was basically dead. And we're sitting up there at Cedar Sinai, and I drove up there every single day for 7 weeks. And she came through it. I mean, it was just like this miracle. And when she, I mean, if you could have seen her, it was hideous. And it was one of the hardest times in my sobriety because I love this woman. I love her more than a sister. And she kind of came to, and her husband and I are in the room, and we're like all excited. And she's like going like this, and I'm thinking, okay, this is profound, right? She's going to tell me what it was like. Because she died a couple of times. At the time, Sandra Bullock and Jesse James were having problems. And so she came up to me and she said, so what happened with Sandra and Jesse? I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding? I'm like, oh my God. I'd slap you if you didn't have so many things all around you. And it was like, oh my God. And I mean, what it is we, the message there is, you know what? We don't have to take things so seriously. And the gift I see in sobriety is, what my sponsor has told me over and over and over again, is there's flowers, there's bouquets everywhere in our lives. It's just whether or not we want to see them or not. You know, I mean, we can have a bad thing happen to us, and really it's a good thing. We can have a good thing happen to us, and really it's a bad thing. So who are we to judge what's good and what's bad? You know, I'm just supposed to look and see what lesson is in it for me. Not to say that things don't hurt, not to say that things go badly, not to say that life sometimes that I haven't walked through some really, really painful times. I have. But on the other side, if I'm going to go through all that pain, I damn well better get something out of it, you know? And so I'm going to try to figure out what it is. And then, you know, and it's a process. It's a process. And, you know, and it doesn't happen right away. Sometimes it takes a couple years for me to see. But eventually it does come. And through, I guess, for all the new people here, there were a lot of new people. And, you know, bless your hearts for being here over the holidays, because it can be such a difficult time because there's so many conflicting things going on sometimes. And, I mean, and so what I can do is just stay here. Just stay. What I have found is I trusted the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did what they told me to do. I believed they knew better than I did. I believed that they had the answer. Now, if it was up to me, there is no way that you can tell me that driving from Lakewood to San Diego on a Saturday night after all this holiday festivities, and my boyfriend's in his jammies already watching the game, Michigan, which I'm glad I'm here because I keep losing all the time. But U of M. So that this is going to make me feel good, I know now that it will. Like we were talking about, I hate doing this, but I know driving home, I'm going to feel really good. I'm going to put a little bit more insurance policy on my sobriety, a little bit more. And so just trust the people. Do things you don't want to do. Just believe that they know better. Take an action you do not yet believe in. And stay here and you'll be fine. Thank you.